Hello, everybody. It's great to be here again. I was at Cambridge last week, and it was a really, really fantastic experience to hear about what everyone's doing around health coaching and changing the conversation. So I'm here to talk to you today about conversations with communities, and I'm going to talk about health coaching as part of that, but talk a little bit to start with about what we mean by community and why community is important. But first, just about the Coalition for Collaborative Care, could I just take a show of hands? Has anyone heard of us before? So it's about a third, so that's great. So the Coalition for Collaborative Care is a partnership of national organisations. This is nearly all of our organisations here on this slide, and committed to a better deal for people with long-term conditions through what we call the three C's. So the first C is better conversations between health professionals and the people they support. And obviously health coaching is a really, really important part of that, along with other processes such as care and support planning, shared decision making. The second C is about strong communities, and that's what I'm going to talk to you today about, and how we get a lot of our well-being from communities and how we need to have a community-based approach to a lot of this. And it's not just about what happens in that one-to-one interaction that's important. And thirdly, co-production. That's the third C. So co-production being embedded at every level, whether it's a strategic decision-making level or co-delivery, co-design. And I'll talk a little bit about that this afternoon. So, but first, I'm going to do a quiz with you. So this is a slide I've ruthlessly stolen from the Royal Society of Arts, Manufactures and Commerce, where I used to work. But I have at least cited them on here. I just want you to hold in your minds what you think this community looks like. So this is area one. So this community has a fifth of people with no qualifications. So the national average is 13%, but it's quite higher here, the amount of people who've got no qualifications at all. The percentage of people who have problems with writing is 38% higher than the national average. Only 3% of people belong to groups with their neighbours. Teenage pregnancy rate is really high. And 18% of people feel very unsafe going out after dark, which is twice the national average. Have you got a picture of what you think that community might look like in your mind? Okay, so now think about area two. So this is an area where almost half the population are educated to degree level or above. And that's much higher than the national average, actually. Over three quarters have got broadband or dial-up at home, so they're digitally connected. It's got a rich, empowered community and voluntary sector. Over 70 organisations and activists have been found in this area. 95% of people undertake the recommended amount of exercise. So that's really, really great. And there's a 40% reduction recently in people feeling very unsafe going out after dark. Have you got a picture in your mind what that community looks like? So where do you think they fall in terms of the scales of deprivation? So a lot of you will be familiar with this, the index of multiple deprivation. So on the left-hand side, you've got the most deprived communities in the UK. So this is like a ward level, a council ward level. And on the right-hand side, you've got the least deprived. So shout out, where do you think area one might fall? Do you want to shout out a number? What sort of percentage do you think?
10%.
In the bottom 10%? Anyone share that? Any other views? About 10? What about area two? 80? Yeah, so they're not deprived at all? Let's have a look. So here we go. This is area one. So Richard, you were almost right there. It's about in the 18% most deprived areas of the country. Let's have a look at area two. Same place. So we make assumptions all the time about the skills and assets in our communities. We think that just because somewhere has got a high teenage pregnancy rate or levels of crime are high, that there is nothing there. There's nothing there for us to build on. But actually, it's very much like Andrew was saying, the principle is the same in health coaching or whether working with communities. We can't make those assumptions. What we need to do is have the right conversations in the right places to open up what's possible and open up how we can build well-being for everybody. So asking the right questions. I mean, when I was thinking about this, I was thinking about I'd gone to speak in an area which shall remain nameless, I was at the Health and Wellbeing Board, and the Health and Wellbeing Board was hearing a report from NHS England and Public Health England and lots of really important people about how they had tried to improve oral health for the children in that area recently. So it's one of the worst places for oral health in the entire country for children. And so what they'd done is they'd brought in £2 million of extra funding in this one fairly small place to try and address the problem. But they'd spent all the money on giving it to dentists to improve access. The £2 million in this place had gone to pay dentists more money to give more appointments. Now, I'm not denying that access to dental health would have been an issue, but I just wondered what might have happened with that £2 million if they'd asked this question instead. If they'd actually gone into communities and instead of saying, how satisfied are you with the level of access for your dentist? People are always going to say no, aren't they? It's never going to be completely convenient. If they'd actually said, what could we do together to improve the dental health of our children around here, and there's £2 million, I'm pretty sure they would have come up with hugely innovative and imaginative ways to spend that money, which may have involved more nurse care, more peer-to-peer support, more community development, more stuff about healthy eating, more about community solutions, and I think they probably would have gone further. So my kind of challenge is, how can we have that paradigm shift to, instead of thinking about what we want to do is improve our services, is actually working with communities to achieve so much more from the money that was actually around, and it was fairly recently, even in times of austerity, that this happened. And then I found this quote, which was great. So apparently Einstein said if he had an hour to answer a question, if he had an hour to solve a problem, he would spend 55 minutes thinking about the right question, and he would only spend 5 minutes thinking about the answer, because actually once he had the right question, the answer would kind of flow from that. So again, with coaching, it's very, very similar to having conversations with communities. You start with the right question. So this is a question that they use a lot in local area coordination. Has anyone heard of local area coordination? So it's a way of turning social care on its head. So it starts with one-to-one support, very similar to health coaching in a lot of ways, plus communities and building community connections. So the actual social care services are the kind of last thing that the person needs. It's actually turning the system on its head. And the question is, what would make a good life for you as you get older? So I'm just going to ask you to have that conversation with the person next to you, just about 2 or 3 minutes. So what would make a good life for you as you get older? What matters to you? What would keep you well if you develop a long-term condition or if you have a long-term condition now? What's going to keep you going until you're 120? What would make a good life for you? Just a couple of minutes, have that conversation with each other. So I just was wondering if maybe kind of one person per table could give us a shout out, one thing that's going to make them, what's make a good life for them as they get older. So should we start with this table here? Somebody on this table, shout out, what were you discussing? What would make a good life for you?
A full and active life with friends, not being lonely, being a participant in society, cramming it all in, we said, cramming everything in well.
Life, doing it with people you love, cramming it all in. So you mentioned friends and family there as well, yeah. This table, what did you come up with? So having choices.
Yeah, having those choices, being able to do all the things you want to do in life.
Being able to do all the things you want to do and having choices. Table behind them.
Financial security.
Yeah, that brings choice. Table behind.
I like
cycle paths. So that you can cycle and feel safe doing it. Yeah, yeah. That table? Excitement and new experiences, yeah, definitely, definitely. I'm going to go right to the back now, Helen's table. Sense of purpose, feeling that you're doing something that's meaningful. Actually, you sort of said a little bit about that down here, didn't you, Liz? Sorry, I should have got the roving mic ready. I didn't ask them for one, it's my fault. One more table then, if you have Mike's table.
Just flexibility.
Flexibility, it's a bit like choice, isn't it? You want choices, yeah, be able to be flexible. So I mean, I've probably asked this 1,000 people above, and what I do is I like to draw the petals of the flower, you know, like the good life, so you can write them. I like that. And people say the same things. It doesn't matter who you ask. You can go into a, you know, deprived council estate, or you can talk to a bunch of chief executives, and they're all saying the same thing that you've just said, really. People say they want to get out and about and see their family and friends. They don't want to be stuck in the house, carry on doing the things they love. And when somebody said going to gigs, you know, when I'm 92, I want to be going to gigs like I'm going now. Holidays, travelling, seeing new things, using my skills. So a sense of kind of like, you know, I've got something. You know, I was a businesswoman. I can write checks. I've still got those skills. But also learning new things. So I've always wanted to learn the guitar, you know, and now is my time. So Martin Routledge, who was the director of the coalition before me, just bought himself a guitar. So there you go. He's just kind of stepped down from his role and he's bought himself a guitar. So it's doing those things. And that's what's important. And the Office of Public Management asked this question. They went out into Camden and they said, what makes a good life for you? Or a question similar to that. And what they came up with was actually that a lot of the things that people were talking about were things like support networks, trust and neighbourliness. You talked about cycle paths. Well, that's about having the right sort of things in place, isn't it? So that you feel safe to go out in the community, being active. And actually, they did mention services, but it was actually a really, really small part of people's lives. And I think sometimes we think that, you know, kind of like we're professionals and we're like really important, but actually it's a kind of quite a small part of people's lives compared to what really matters to people. So a health coaching conversation will get you to the bottom of some of that, but actually a conversation with a larger group of people in a community will also get you some of that too. So Think Local App Personal defined, well, what they call social capital, but what I'm going to be talking about a little bit is personal social support networks of family, friends and community, being part of a group, whether formal or informal, is absolutely vital for your health and well-being, being part of an inclusive community where you feel safe and you feel valued for something that you can contribute as well, which is, I think, what Helen was saying. And this isn't woolly stuff. There is evidence to show that this is actually kind of life or death stuff. So this is a slide I've got from Brian Fisher from New NHS Alliance. They're one of our partners. And it shows six months survival after heart attack by levels of emotional support. And that you can see, actually, if you have no social support, you're much, much more likely to die than if you have two or more forms of social support. So actually, the really crucial conversation after somebody's had a heart attack is... who have you got in your life, you know? Do you get out much? You know, who do you talk to? Who have you got to support you? Who could help you if you had a problem? That person's social capital being absolutely vital for their survival, in fact, not just well-being. And this one is a meta-analysis across over 300,000 people showing that actually social networks have a really protective effect against all-cause mortality. And that's if you kind of adjust for smoking, age, BMI, all of those things. We talk about giving up smoking as being the most important lifestyle intervention, but actually being lonely is just as bad. And I'm going to flick through some of these, but there's loads of evidence that we can point you to in the Coalition for Collaborative Care showing that, you know, we talk about your standard treatment might be cholesterol lowering drugs to prevent heart attacks, but actually somebody with a strong social network, you've almost got about the same effect. So if you could do both together, you know, wouldn't that be great? So this is a case study of some work that Brian Fisher and colleagues did in Solihull, I think. But it was part of what they called the Health Empowerment Leverage Project, a bit of a mouthful, HELP for short. And what they were doing is they were having the right conversations in communities about what was great about it, what the skills were, what the assets were, and actually getting people to drive the change themselves. So very much kind of modelling what happens in a health coaching conversation, but at a wider scale, so the residents, the people that lived there, actually driving the change themselves. And brilliant things happened, you know. They managed to increase attainment in school and attendance in school. They reduce crime and they reduce teenage pregnancy, and the environment improved because they got grants in. They managed to get money in to improve playgrounds and things like that. But actually, quite crucially, what they actually looked at was they tracked. They actually looked at the incidence of cardiovascular disease in a particular area, and they actually did an extrapolation of the costs that reckoned that you get almost a 1 in 4 return on investment if you invest in community development. just a modest reduction in cardiovascular disease through using some of the research that's already there could actually lead you to say you get a 1 in 4 investment on community development in this area. And very similar sort of findings to People Powered Health. Nesta is another one of our partners. So they worked in a number of areas across the country. And again, extrapolating what happened where they were able to track people's involvement in community life and practice level data, they actually were able to show that they could, the NHS in England could save £4.4 billion a year if it only empowered people every level, either one-to-one through a health coaching type conversation, at a community level or a strategic level involving people in co-producing decisions and outcomes about the way health services are provided in the local area. Again, there's loads of evidence about the economic impact. So Nesta, Health Foundation and National Voices, again, more of a coalition of collaborative cares partners, have been doing this piece of work called Realising the Value, showing that on this sort of spectrum of interventions which will really, really improve wellbeing and change things, health coaching's right in there. But I suppose what I'm talking about is the stuff which is kind of more in the orange, is sort of nested in community. I know Jim Phillips is going to be talking later in his workshop, if you're lucky enough to have signed up to that one, about peer-to-peer and sort of coach community level sort of coaching model, so it doesn't necessarily have to be with a clinician, although that's the model I know we've talked a lot about this morning. So lastly, I think I've got 1 minute left. I'm just going to talk about time banking. So this is Rushy Green Time Bank, and this is the Oxford Road Time Bank, which I started in Reading. And time banking is a way of people being able to share their assets, skills and gifts with each other and earn time credits for the help they give each other in return. So somebody might do a bit of ironing for an hour and earn a time credit for that, and then they spend that on somebody decorating a cake for their daughter's birthday. I'm just thinking of myself, what I need, because I'm not very good at cake decorating. And every hour that you spend, you get a time credit, and everyone's hour is worth the same, so it's very equal. And when people join our time bank, we have a person-centred conversation with them. We ask them what really are their assets. Gifts of the head, so what they know, what they believe and what they're passionate about, that's gifts of the heart, and gifts of the hands. So have they got any skills like playing the guitar or speaking a language or website design that they could kind of throw into this community mix and could help create well-being in this community? And I think time banking is possibly a way of really kind of grasping that the interface between what happens between health professionals and people and what happens out in community, because I think a lot of these conversations are going on and could really help health professionals, and I think vice versa, health professionals could really help time banking if we were linked in with the people perhaps with long-term conditions who kind of needed a bit of social support in the area. So one of my aims, I keep saying this, it's quite difficult to get over the door, is to go and talk to my GP practice and say, look, we're in your area, we want to help, how can we do this together? And this is a quote from somebody attending Rushy Green Time Bank, so basically talking about something which can't be cured, which was making her extremely miserable, she was living in pain the whole time, but the time bank just made her feel better because of the social support that she gets, and because actually she's got somebody to call on, but also people call on her, so she's got a sense of value and worth. And lastly, I love this one. The pictures are a bit blurred. Now it's been blown up. But this is the Green Fingers Project in Redruth, Cornwall. And this was also something that came out of the HELP, Health Empowerment Leverage Project. And it's still going, because I was Googling it last night to look for some more up-to-date pictures, because this is about 5 years old now, but it's still going. And this was a project that was set up after people were having the right conversations in a community. They had a group of disaffected young people who weren't in education or jobs, were actually causing a bit of, you know, bother around the neighbourhood. They had a lot of older people living on an estate who were getting to the stage where they didn't feel they could maintain their gardens anymore. And we know that actually not being able to maintain your garden is quite often, that's the point at which somebody might need to go into residential care, hugely increasing the costs and in some ways maybe worse well-being for them. That might not be what they want. They might want to stay in their own home. And they just got together and said, what can we do together? So they got this project called the Green Fingers Project, where they offered the young people training in horticulture at the local college for free. Whilst they were doing their training, they were maintaining all the gardens on the estate, saving the housing association thousands of pounds a year. the older people were suddenly seeing these lads as actually with something to, you know, something to give, something to contribute, rather than something which was like really awful, and they were kind of like hanging around on street corners and making them feel intimidated. And why were they doing it, you ask? Well, it's because the police were involved and they were giving them driving lessons, because the police were concerned about stolen cars and joyriding, and actually they thought, well, if we teach them how to drive, at least they'll be doing it properly. So it was a win-win for everybody, and this is still going, and it came from a conversation. So just a few things that I think, how can we do it? I think we need to invest in community development at the same time as investing in the one-to-one conversation. We need to practice what's called host leadership. So we invite people into the conversation, but then we don't seek to control it. We step back and see what amazing flowers can bloom out of the conversation. We have to have the right conversation, starting with people's lives and not services, and ask the right questions and really listen, being present. If we've only got that 10 minutes, how can we really be present and really listen? This has got to be at a hyper-local level. It can't be at an STP level. It's too big. It's got to be my street, my town, my place. And we need to be able to be prepared to be work with citizens to explore what's possible, and not always think as professionals we've got the answers. Thank you.